And hello, good people of the internet. It is I, Tommy Kelly. This is Adventures in Woo Woo, and welcome to the latest episode. And as you can tell by the length of time it was since the last episode, that these episodes are going to come out when they come out. There is no kind of set schedule for us. It's not fortnightly, monthly. Hopefully it'll be more than bi-monthly or half-yearly or whatever. But yeah, it's just going to come out when they come out. I have to find a way of doing them where they kind of become a bit quicker or more efficient, I think is probably a better word of it. At the minute, it takes about 2, maybe 3 days to actually do it, and a couple of weeks beforehand of thinking about the things I want to talk about. And when I was back in the day when I was doing it, I used to just do it off the cuff, no preparing whatsoever, maybe a couple of notes, and then no editing whatsoever. I kind of like the edited, pristine version of it as it is now in some ways. Maybe I'll go back to quantity over quality at some point. But yeah, let's not linger too long in the preamble, or else we'll be here all day. Let's get into what the topic of this one is about, which is channeling, which I think an argument could be made, and I'm not sure I'm going to be making this argument, or at least I'm not going to be successfully making this argument, that all magic is a form of channeling. So let's get into that. So as usual with all of these kind of subjects, I think the best place to start is not where it starts, but I suppose where I come along on the journey, where I come across all of this kind of stuff. And this one's easy because it turns out that the two influences that I had are the two first exposures to spirituality in some way are connected to channeling. The two people, and I've talked about this numerous times, but I assume that if you were listening to this podcast, you have at least some interest in the things I say and my influence and the people that I've talked about many times. And these people are, of course, Alice Bailey and Stuart Wild. For those who are new, when I was about 11, 12, preteen, something like that, my auntie came over from the UK. She was living in the UK. We were in Ireland, still in Ireland. And she used to talk to me about spirituality and religion and all of these things. And I was fascinated. And her two influences that she sent me over, or give to me, I suppose, was Stuart Wild and Theosophy. And mostly Theosophy in the Alice Bailey, neo-Theosophy type stuff. The Arcane School, the Lucis Trust, all of that stuff, which conspiracy theorists really dislike or are very suspect of. And maybe rightly so. And the Alice Bailey stuff is the most obvious kind of channeling kind of stuff out of the two. It wasn't until years later that I realised that Stuart Wild also had a channeling type influence, a massive influence. But we'll come back to that in a bit. The Alice Bailey stuff, as with all the kind of Theosophy stuff, well, not all of it, but a lot of it, like the original Helena Petrova Blavatsky stuff, is also channeled. Well, I say channeled, but neither HBB or Alice Bailey would accept channeling as what it is that they do. But it's kind of an easy kind of, you know, statement, a word or description of what it is that you can quickly throw out there and people will know what you're saying. That it's not that they are writing it. In some way, it's some other higher being writing it. And in these cases, the HBB and Alice Bailey, it was an ascended master. In Alice Bailey's version of things, the master is Dwal Cool, who initially doesn't come out as a master, calls himself a student or a fellow brother or someone just slightly along the ladder a bit more, but somehow gets outed along the way as being this ascended master Dwal Cool. He's called in all of the writings, he's called a Tibetan. He's never actually still outed officially, I suppose, but everyone knows it's Dwal Cool. He seems to have written some of the stuff with HBB as well, although I think Kutumi, or perhaps Moira, is more to blame, if you want, or more involved in HPB stuff. As much as I've read Blavatsky's stuff, I'm not as close to it or as knowledgeable about it as I am the Bailey stuff. Not that I'm tremendously knowledgeable about the Bailey stuff. There's 24 books stacked full of information that I'm not sure anyone could get fully to grip with. Oh, maybe they can. I should suggest only that maybe I can't. And so the idea with it is that early in her career, Alice Bailey had some interesting experiences where she's seen a picture and says, "That's my master," and was completely shunned and told, "That's not what you do." This was in some sort of Theosophy center. And then one guy just turns up one day and goes, "You'll be writing books for us." And she goes, "No, I certainly won't." And of course, ended up writing books. There seems to be some part of it, and this comes back later when we talk about Helen Schuckman. There seems to be some part of this thing where you, and I think it's a part of all kind of magic, but it seems to be quite prevalent in channeling as well, that you're asked to do this wonderful thing and you have to say no. And if you say yes, then you're played with a bit, or kind of seen as not ready. And what I mean by this is that it's not exactly channeling in the sense of that it's that you're taking, I don't know, like you're in some way possessed, that this Dwal Cool character has taken over Alice Bailey's body and, you know, has the hands on the typewriter or holding the pencil, whatever way it was that she wrote the stuff. That's not how they describe it. And I think even HBB, because she was out around the kind of the time of when spiritualism was, you know, really popular and mediumship was really popular. And she tried to distance herself, particularly from the word medium and channeling in some regards. That's not what she's doing. I came across a quote from Daryl Anka, who is the channel for being known as Bashar. You probably have come across him. He's a real kind of hyper, weird voice of a guy from the future. And he says this about how he describes what the channeling is. And he says, so, the idea of channeling is not possession or anything like that. It is a synchronization of frequencies that allow you to have the same thoughts at the same time as whoever you are vibrating on the same wavelength with. So what does that mean? Well, it's kind of saying that he's saying, and I think Alice Bailey would agree with this, you get into a rapport with this higher being or this other being, and your brains synchronize, and you have this kind of a sense of, as he says, the thoughts are present that are also present in the other higher being. The thoughts are present in your brain as they are in the higher being. So it's not really possession, it's just that both of you have access to the same thing, or, you know, the rapport probably is better, a descriptor as they would see it. And so, as I said, those 24 books, and not all of them, I think two of them she officially wrote herself, and the rest are considered channeled or rapport. And, you know, they're intensely detailed work and an awful lot of depth to them, and you know, really well written. And you know, you have this kind of a notion that, well, a human couldn't really have written that because it's so advanced or so, you know, it's all connected. And but who knows? I mean, I've read some complicated books that certainly weren't ever being presented as being channeled. Then come back to Stuart Wilde. There's an interesting about him, like for years, 20 years of Stuart Wilde was before I realised that his teacher, who he never really names in any of his lectures or in any of his books, he names him just as his teacher, but it's Marshall N. Lever, who was the channel for a spirit, I don't know what the correct word for some sort of energy. I don't think he quite thinks of it as a spirit, but as an energy called Old Chinese or Chung Fu. And an awful lot of where Stuart gets his ideas from or his influence from are from these channeled sessions, particularly the 33 Energies of Man, which Stu taught, which became his book Infinite Self. And there's a tape series, and it's one of my favourite bits of Stuart. It's really good. All seems to have come from the teaching of this Marshall N. Lever. There is a book he wrote, Marshall Lever, called The Search for the Secret Door, in which he goes through the various different insights he has had. They don't all quite align with Stuart, but you know, there is an overlap and there is some similarity. Stu did talk about the fact that he was part of the spiritualist movement and that he had trained to become a sort of a medium. And so I was aware of that. But he only did it for a while and ended up not getting an awful lot out of it, he said, other than it was very interesting. But that he found that the people he ended up talking to, you know, the dead people, your aunties, your uncles, your grandfathers, all of these people, didn't really seem to have any more access to any knowledge than they did when they were alive. You know, there's this kind of a notion, and it's come a lot in magic, I think, as well, particularly in chaos magic, that there's this notion that your ancestors or the people who have passed over can in some way help you in a kind of a mode or a regard or a fashion that they wouldn't really have been able to do in real life. And what do I mean by that? It's like this kind of a notion that now that you can talk to your dead grandmother, you know, she's dead, so she's over, and you can do some ancestor work, that in some way she will be able to influence situations in your life or help you out in situations in your life, like getting a new job or, you know, increased wealth or knowledge or something like that. And you kind of have to ask yourself, while that sounds good on paper, say, would she have been able to do that when she was alive? And if not, does that mean that dead people become more powerful all of a sudden and have a greater influence? It's like you see this kind of idea better explained, I suppose, that when you have the idea of a dead pet and then in some way, you know, you have it as a familiar, or you're trying some way to bring it in as your ancestors, and then, you know, for maybe for luck or again for increasing money or, you know, whatever it is that you would use that, you know, your dead spirit animal. And you kind of go, well, a cat can't get me a job now. A cat can't get me knowledge now. It can certainly give me company and it can give me solace, and you know, it can sit on my knee and make me feel good and we can have good times. But it's like now that he's dead, to somehow that they're bestowed, it's often touted that they're bestowed some extra quality of being able to, you know, actually have some sort of big magical influence on your life, even more than you. And I find that very strange. I was never able to fully get behind that kind of notion, that because people are dead, they now have more power, influence, and they're probably more useful to you dead than they are alive, which, I don't know, something about that thought that I really don't like. But anyway, Stewart was saying that the more he did this kind of spirit medium stuff where he'd be talking to people, their dead relatives, it always kind of started off with them saying things like, oh, you know, you've had a hard time, but things are going to get better. You know, everything's going to be okay. Everything's, you know, happy and, you know, everyone's going to work out. And he just kind of felt that if people were, you know, had a lack of, say, knowledge or intelligence in their day-to-day life, their real life, then they didn't seem to suddenly get the secrets of the universe once they died. They tended to retain the same type of power, personality, influence, and such things that they did in real life. So that kind of throws, in one sense, me the whole notion of ancestor work. Unless, of course, you know, that when you're going into a wider kind of ancestor working thing, these people were, you know, quite knowledgeable, were awakened or enlightened or wizards or witches or in some way they could impart some information to you or some magic knowledge to you or something like that, or they had a great kind of knowledge around finances or business or something like that, that they could in fact, you know, help you out in a kind of energetic transfer type of thing. But if it's just your kind of your standard, you know, salt of the air type person, you know, worked on a farm his entire life, didn't see much of the world, wouldn't have no idea what the internet is, then how exactly are we to expect that they in some way, unless it's just like an energetic boost, you know, a bit of chi or something that they can help influence things now. That's not to say I don't think you shouldn't honour, you know, the mighty dead, but just that kind of transactional thing of hoping they can do stuff for you. Maybe not, you know, like, does it make sense? But does any of this make sense? So as I was saying, it took me a while before I found out that Stewart had this kind of background in channeling. But I found it interesting, and some of the tapes, when you listen back to old Chinese, you know, it has this notion, this thing. It has this thing in channeling, which I find very odd, but probably it's part of it, that people do this weird voice, you know, when they're channeling, and they all have the same kind of diction. You know, there's an uncanny valley thing to it that when you hear someone doing the kind of stereotypical channeling of some spirit talking through them. And you seem to get an awful lot of, like, you know, wise man Chinese people, and you get an awful lot of, like, Native American type stuff that seems to come through an awful lot with people. While at the time seemed quite acceptable, now we kind of look at it and go, oh, well, that's dodgy. That, you know, you can't be doing that voice, white man. You know what I mean? You're white woman. That's really not appropriate. But, you know, I suppose it was some, well, I assume it was acceptable at the time, given the, you know, the prevalence of that kind of stuff. So I suppose then the next big, I would say influence, but it ultimately didn't become an influence. It became, what's the opposite of an influence? A de-influence would be Helen Schuckman and A Course in Miracles. And that was also a very much a channeled work. The person in this case, though, was Jesus, who was channeling through a Jewish woman who was ostensibly an atheist. And that's probably the most popular of all of the channeled works that is available. Like, you could get so many people who are surprisingly into that or have been influenced by that book. I really tried my best to get into it, and some of it I really like, but ultimately it's a Gnostic Jesus. It's everything is an illusion, suffering doesn't exist, all of this is a mistake, you know, and I just, that kind of stuff, I don't gel with at all. I don't think it is true. It's not my experience of things. It's not my understanding of things. But again, as I said before, just because it's not my preference, I have to be very aware that that doesn't make it not true. I did a number of times try to do the year-long course that comes with it, and sometimes more successful than others. But it's ultimately that thing that none of this is real, none of this matters, you don't matter, your suffering isn't real, people don't matter, this world is a mistake. It's the line in it is that one crazy idea or something like that, that we had, that we are separate from God. And there's no God here either. God can't have any part of this because it is false, because it's not, you know, it's not reality. And so this is a godless existence. But we do have the Holy Spirit, which is God's answer to this huge separation, which is, you know, it comes in, that comes in many different forms in many different places. But ultimately, the Gnostic stuff, it just doesn't sit with me, or just doesn't sit with me. Because you have people like Abraham Hicks, which like kind of that whole The Secret movie that came out, that was originally going to be, as far as I can gather, a documentary about Abraham Hicks, or they were going to have the main kind of picture in it, or the main kind of, they were going to be the center of it. And of course that all got edited out because it was deemed to be too weird, because she was, you know, channeling the spirit called Abraham, Esther Hicks was, and doing a weird voice, which she kind of over the years less and less does this weird voice. I did spend some time with Abraham Hicks just to see, you know, like, it was part of my period of life where I was trying to have a better life, you know, trying to use spirituality to try and ease my existence a bit rather than trying to escape it, you know, rather than trying to awaken or enlighten myself or in some way, you know, leave the matrix, wake up from the simulation. Even then, even, you know, I wanted to have a better experience. And that part of it was like coming from having taken a break from spirituality after I went to college and I did holistic health studies and Reiki and Indian head massage and aromatherapy and an awful lot of kind of woo-woo type stuff. Not all woo-woo. Aromatherapy has its actual scientific effects, just not as much as the social media would want you to believe. But I kind of got burnt out by that. So it was like the secret then that got me back into it, and the Abraham Hicks stuff and all that. And I mean, it's not that I don't want to ever dismiss the law of attraction, because it certainly has worked for me on numerous occasions. But it's kind of like a temporary fix on something. It's like avoid the real work by having this shiny thing. You know, it should be a small part of a larger kind of spiritual outlook. But the Abraham Hicks stuff, I ultimately didn't like at all, because it's saying that you don't even have to work for it. You don't even have to move towards your goals. You don't have to do anything. You can literally sit on your couch and have positive thoughts about getting a Tesla and it will turn up, which it doesn't. I mean, it just doesn't. That's not how it works. I don't know. I there was a kind of a disillusionement around all that. And I mean, and there's plenty of other kind of channel stuff. I mean, I watched an awful lot of documentaries and stuff over the last while, just about channeling, just trying to find as much information as I could just about the different things. And there's so many people doing it. So many influences, so many books, whole tape series, plenty of people doing weird voices, doing, you know, talking about some either from like the future, from the Pleiades, UFOs, aliens, different spirits, all of these things. And an awful lot of, there is an awful lot of crossover in all of it, what they teach and all of that. But it's, I don't know. I don't really know what I think about all that. So they were mostly my exposures to the whole kind of world of channeling, which is like Alice Bailey, Stuart Wilde, Abraham Hicks, Helen Schuckman, and probably there's others that I'm just forgetting, obviously didn't make a lasting impact on me. But having done The 40 Servants and having done music and having done comics and having had a very kind of creative output, I often have said that it feels an awful lot like channeling, but not in the way that I'm aware of a consciousness who has a name, who also probably has a physical body somewhere. It's not that. It's something very different. And this isn't just something that I alone experience or see, that people, artists, musicians, painters, lots of people talk about this in the same kind of way, but slightly different words, just trying to describe something that's very hard to describe. And I often pull back from saying that what I do is channeling, because people would get the wrong idea, particularly around something around 40 servants, which for people who don't know is 40 servitors or thought forms, which we talked about in a previous podcast. And I think if you start saying, oh, well, this is channeled material, it kind of lends an authority to it that it doesn't really deserve, in the sense of that, oh, this has kind of come down as the word of God, where, you know, if I said the 40 servants were channeled, it's like as if they existed previous to me creating them, that they came from a higher place and I am just a vessel through which they have their own agenda to come out. And I think people get the wrong idea about it, even though that's somewhat how I, you know, how I would describe it at other times. But it's also how I describe writing music. It's also how I describe doing everything. And this is the thing that I alluded to at the beginning, where I'm saying that I think there's a good argument to be made that all magic is a form of channeling. And what do I mean by that? Well, what I mean is that if we go back to when we were talking about the Lord and the Lady and the Child in the second episode, where I was saying that the kind of the whole idea is to bring the light or the spirit into the material world, you know, and to make this, to redeem this material world. By that I mean to inspire, to inspirit, to bring spirit into this world, to make this place holy, to make this place spirit. That's what I mean by channeling, in that it's you're bringing something from the darkness, bringing something from the unmanifest, from the chaos, from the potentiality, from where all things are possible but not actualized, and manifesting or actualizing them here. And it's kind of almost like remembering something. But I don't like that either, because it implies that everything's already been done and that, but therefore there's no creativity, there's no expansion, which is something I feel is very, very true, that this whole thing is creative, it's expansive, it's moving outwards. It's not something that's already done, or it's not something that once was revealed and we have forgot in some way, like we're falling into some sort of state of disgrace. All these things that we once knew and we have forgotten, and the whole point is to try and remember them once again. I don't think that's what it is. That's not what I'm trying to describe, or that's not how I feel in the thing of remembering. It's kind of like a feeling of, if you're writing a song and the song's coming out and you can feel the presence of the song, you know, the idea is arriving, whatever, and you're almost like a midwife trying to get that out, and it can feel like remembering because you're playing D and you have the melody da 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 da, and you go to G, oh no, it's not G, it's not G, that's not what it is, and it's A, oh it's A, that's what it, that's what, and it's like you're kind of slotting in the jigsaw pieces or whatever, and your kind of whole point, or my main thing, is trying to be as empty a vessel as possible, where you're just letting the thing be whatever it is, without trying to impose your will on it, without trying to impose your particular preferences on it, or what you want it to be. You know, like this song is coming out and it's a country song and I meant a grunge, so I'm going to make it into a grunge song, and then you ruin both grunge, country and the song. It's just to let it be whatever it is. And when I say that it's kind of like remembering, that's what I mean, in that there's something coming through that you're trying to grasp and you're trying to bring in as intact as possible, rather than it's something that existed necessarily and you forgot about. Although it can kind of feel like that. But like, I mean, it existed in the sense of it existed in potentiality and now it's becoming manifest. And there's a couple of good examples of this, of other people being more articulate about it than probably I am. And one of them is in a documentary about U2 when they were going back looking over recording Act on Baby 20 years later, 25 years later after it came out. And they're listening to some recordings that they did at the time in Hansa Studios in Berlin, when they were trying to write all the different songs and having an awful time of it, just not working out for them. And there's a point where they're doing Mysterious Ways and it's going kind of nowhere, and it kind of evolves into something else. And Bono talks about it, and The Edge talks about the fact that you can tell that something came into the room. And that sounds really, really woo-woo. And I don't think they mean that a presence of like a person or a ghost or something that came in, but this, you can tell that the idea is there. And if you've never had that experience, then it sounds very bizarre. But if you have had that experience, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. And you know exactly what they're talking about. That you go, here it is. There's an idea here, there's something here that's trying to get out, and immediately grasp it and they move into it, you know, they drop the Mysterious Ways to kind of go, whoa, what is this, where's this going, what's the feel of this, what's the energy of it, you know, like playing around chords, right? No, it's not that, it's not that, it's not that. And I mean, ultimately and very quickly the song comes out and it's One, you know, which is one of their biggest songs, particularly from that period. And it's great that they have that recorded and have a recording of that where they can look back and listen to that whole experience of when something arrived. And you know, their job then is then just to work out, what is this? What is this thing? You know, don't impose their own wants or needs on top of this. Go, let this show itself. You know, let's see what this is. John Lennon has a quote about finding it hard to write songs and then one arriving. I spent 5 hours that morning trying to write a song that was meaningful and good. And I finally gave up and lay down. Then Nowhere Man came, words and music, the whole damn thing as I lay down. Songwriting is about getting the demon out of me. It's like being possessed. You can try to go to sleep, but the song won't let you. You have to get up and you have to make it into something, and then you're allowed to sleep. I've had an experience once of a song coming out, start to finish, all chords, lyrics, melody, everything. I've had many experiences where stuff like that has happened, but this is one where the whole entire thing, as described by John Lennon there, came, just arrived, start to finish, all the lyrics, everything. It's very bizarre because sometimes you get, you know, a bit of a song that you then have to work on, or you get a verse and a chorus, and then, you know, you have to write the second verse, and you go, oh, I hate writing lyrics, whatever it is. But this was the entirety, first verse, second verse, middle bit, bridge, the whole lot. And that was fascinating. It's going, what, that just totally just flew out of me. When I was writing Turbine Syndrome, I was kind of working away. I knew there was something in all of this. I knew there was an idea here. I knew there was the whole thing. And then at one point, there was the download. And then it was like, it all kind of fell into place. But an awful lot of it is kind of preparing the groundwork for this idea to arrive, this kind of thing. You know, like with the U2 thing, they were in the studio just trying to come up with stuff, trying to allow inspiration to hit and be ready when it did. Same with John Lennon. It was him. He was trying, but it was when he gave up, when he opened up the space for whatever it was that was trying to come out, rather than just kind of demanding that something came out. And so when I was doing Turbine Syndrome, I was kind of trying to open up the space where I was getting into the art style that maybe would suit it, working out the different kind of approaches, the different techniques, all of these things, having a kind of vague notion of what it is I wanted to do, but it's just allowing it to be whatever it was. And I think that's the approach I have to all of these things. And particularly like the 47s, was allow it to be whatever it was. I mean, in one sense, when I look at the 47s and I look at how it worked out and how it, all the things kind of fell together and how the different servants relate to each other and the different cards and how everything seems to be covered, all the different kind of notions you could have, you can kind of go, how did I work that all that out? You know, some of it is, of course, serendipity, and some of it's, you know... be blagging that or changing, not blagging, but changing things later or whatever. But I feel there's something bigger at work there. And that's what I'm saying, that I think all of these things, all of magic, all of creativity, all of our lives, all of everything is some form of channeling. But I don't mean it in the sense of that it's necessarily old Chinese coming down going, why don't you do the healer? Put her as a maker, as a nurse, you know, it'll work well with the sun. It's not that. It's just kind of getting out of the way to allow this stuff, the spirit, to manifest, to actualize, potentiality to actualize. Alan Moore talks about it when looking back on Watchmen, where he says there's so much in Watchmen that makes absolute sense, that, you know, correlates with other stuff, that has connections, that echoes, that mirrors, that all of these things, that you just go, there's no way that that just happened by accident. He says, but I didn't put it in it. It's only when I was looking back, I go, oh look, that's what that means. I wasn't aware that what that was. And I certainly have had those type of feelings around creativity, particularly around stuff when I've, like the 40 servants, or, you know, like hyper sigils or things like that, where you realise in hindsight, you go, oh wow, that's amazing. I didn't realise that this very important thing holds all of these strands together or makes thing wasn't something I deliberately put in, but I clearly did, because it's me who created it, me who drew it, or me who wrote it, whatever it is. But that it has its own kind of, I don't know, that when you step out of the way of it and allow it to be whatever it is, that there's parts of it that you're creating that you won't understand until later, or that you won't get, or you won't have the insight around, or you won't feel how it's important. And if you are kind of trying to get in the way of it, you might leave out or change, or you go, well, I don't really understand that, or I'm leaving it out. But yet it could end up being the most catalytic part of it, or the thing that's needed the most, or the thing that gains the most insight. So I think the channeling thing that, say, Abraham Hicks is doing, and the channeling thing that I'm doing and that we're all doing when it comes to creativity, I think it's a form of the same thing. I don't think it's that different, other than the bells and whistles, other than the aesthetics. And I think kind of all of our inspirations, all of our kind of desires or wants or wills or things that we want to bring into life or do with life is another form of that, which is why I kind of reject in many ways the kind of Buddhist notion that you shouldn't have desires. You shouldn't have dysfunctional desires. I definitely believe that. Or you shouldn't have material wants. Well, I don't agree with that. I think you shouldn't have dysfunctional material wants. I don't think you should try to fix things necessarily, which is what, as I was saying, my problem with the law of attraction is you're trying to distract or fix things by having stuff. But that then, not to kind of dismiss all of wants, needs, goals, desires, I think it's not for me. And it's when I was talking about the Lord and the Lady stuff in the previous podcast, I was talking about how part of the work as a magician, as I see it, is to look at the suffering in the face, or looking at the sacrifice of the mother in the eyes until she looks at you, and to avoid the desire, to avoid, it's in many ways to avoid growth, to avoid expansion, to avoid creativity. You know, it's to avoid the pressure that turns the carbon into the diamond. And so while there is definitely dysfunction around desire, I think if we look at it from this, you know, wider channeling thing, is why do you have this desire? What is it you're trying to manifest? What is the thing that you're trying to actualize? What is the part of potentiality, of spirit, the father, that you are trying to bring to the world? And then do that, you know, without having any kind of sense of guilt around it, or having any kind of sense that desire is the root of all evil, or that, you know, you should be negating your desires, or in some way suppressing them or whatever, and the fact of wanting thing makes you a bad person or a less spiritual person. And conversely, that by not wanting things or in some way shunning the material world makes you a more spiritual person, which is, you know, that's the negative side of that dysfunction. That's still ego, you know, it's still I'm much better, much greater because I don't want these things, like you people who are part of this material world. I am not, I'm above it all. It's still, you know, it's still prestige. You're still looking for something. It's still ego. It's still looking for a boost to yourself and your self-importance. And so then your desires and your magic should all reflect that kind of a notion that to have desire, to have wants, to have drives, to have passions, to have, you know, all this thing that's in you to want to expand and be creative, and both your spiritual goals and your material goals should align, because it should be all the same. That's magic. That's what I feel is magic. And it's just debate I've had with, not debate, a conversation I've had with many people about when I say that magic and art are the same thing. I think where I went wrong with that with people is that it was as if I was saying that art is the only thing magic is, and you can't have anything outside of it. What I mean is it's the same quality. It's the same expression. It's the same movement. It's the same direction, which is the same direction of channeling, which is the same direction of your ambitions or all of that. It's the same. It feels the same thing. And I can't understand. No, that's unfair. I can understand. But given my experience and my understanding and how my life has been and how creativity works for me and all that, I can't for the life of me see how magic is not art and art is not magic and how they're not synonymous and how it's not all the same thing. But that, for me then, to say that someone who doesn't think that is wrong is imposing the same kind of restriction that they're imposing on me by saying I'm wrong. So I think we all could be experiencing something completely different. And maybe you don't experience magic, channeling, creativity, evolution, expansion, manifesting potentiality, whatever word we want for all of this, in the same way I am. I mean, that idea in Theosophy where there's seven rays, where people are kind of evolving on different kind of trajectories and having different kind of experiences. Well, maybe I wouldn't limit it to maybe exactly seven, or maybe I would. It's like, maybe we are experiencing something different. Maybe it is like the creation of the RPG character, where someone is a wizard, someone is a priest, someone is a monk, someone is a barbarian, and you're all going to have a very different experience, a different worldview, a different lens through which, you know, life is. And all of it's valid and true. And so it shouldn't be rejected just because your experience is different. But for me, I can't see any difference between self-expression, magic, creativity, art, ambition, passions, desires. I don't see any difference between all of it. It all seems the same, a form of the same thing, a same direction, the same principle, the same expansion. Exactly what I talked about. It seems the unfolding of the Lord, the Lady and the Child, as I talked about in the previous episode. That feels right to me. That feels legitimate. Your mileage may vary, of course. I suppose just going back to channeling as it's commonly known, as more, you know, that's kind of spirit channeling, if you want. You have to ask, who exactly are we talking to? And what, you know, if it's not just in the form of, you know, a general idea space where ideas have people rather than people have ideas, you know, the ideas themselves have some sort of volition. But if there's some sort of personality attached to this thing, which it seems to be in an awful lot of the classic kind of channeling things, you know, you have the old Chinese, you have Abraham, you have Jesus, you have whoever. And I mean, of course, the answer to this, in case you're looking for a definitive answer, is I don't know. I don't think anyone knows, because even the people who are channeling say different things about it. You know, like Bashar at different times, Daryl Anka, he says that if you look at it from one thing, the Bashar is, you know, a further incarnation of me, and Bashar would see myself as a, you know, as a previous incarnation of him. But yet at the same time, none of that's true. That's just because you're seeing something within the limits of time, which doesn't exist from a certain dimension, you know, as soon as you move out of it. And there was an interesting thing that I came across a while ago. I'm not really sure where it came from, but I kind of held on to it and I believe it. I suspect it's the truth. And it's probably not, you know, comes from a number of things. But saying the difference between a dead person and a living person is that a dead person isn't trapped by time, that they are outside of time. Whatever it was, the spirit, the animating principle, the spark of divinity, whatever, is now no longer bound by time and can still interact in some way with us. But, it, you know, there's a kind of a barrier, if you want, by this notion of time. But then you have to go, like, which part of me survives death? If we were strictly talking about the channeling, we're talking about talking to dead people, as they would in, like, mediumship and spiritualism and stuff like that. And the way to, I kind of think that you could approach this is by going, well, which part of you now is the person, if you believe in reincarnation, that was the French peasant 300 years ago? Because there's certainly none of us that feels Tommy Kelly is a French peasant from 300 years ago. So it's like all of the stuff that is you but take away all of your, you know, not necessarily your personality, but all of your hang-ups, your traumas, your opinions, your views. Take away your mind. And I think that's the thing that moves on. There's no, if you want, discernment between good and bad. There's no moral judgment in it. It's just, you know, it's like take away all of, you know, the opinions are essentially this is good, this is bad, right? That's kind of it. But if you take all of that away and have that underlying, I suppose, I am this as it's described in many different places, that's probably the thing that moves on. Then if that is the case, then why is it then that people who are mediums and channels and stuff like that talk to people who very much, you know, still seem to have the exact same personality that they had in their life? And the theosophical answer to that is because what you are interacting with is the astral form of them. It's not the real person. Like, so when you die, your inherent thing moves on, returns to the Godhead, whatever way, whatever happens, but that there's this astral impression of you. Because all of this, you know, like I've said before in podcasts, is that what we see in the world is mostly clouded by the astral, which is our opinions about it. It's not that the world isn't real, it's just that we've superimposed a set of rules or a set of ideas over it, including ourselves. You know, so that our astral body is like, in one sense, it's kind of the emotional body. We're emotional about it. You know, we have emotion, we have feelings around it. And so that astral stuff hangs around for ages, seemingly. And that makes sense, you know. And so that's what people are channeling or interacting with. And then, of course, going by what we talked about previously with thought forms, then you're also going to have thought forms that are on the astral plane that you can interact with. And I think that's probably an awful lot of what this channeling is. Rather than actual entities, beings, demons, angels, or whatever, it's an astral form of these things. And I think that's what we're interacting with. And as such, probably don't know as much as they let on to do, you know, or they claim to do. And not in a kind of a, they're deliberately lying or they're trying to deceive you or that. It's in the same way that people have this kind of notion that they know more than they do, and kind of, you know, they're coming from a place of, you know, being delusional in many ways. And I suppose as an astral being that you're going to be slightly more or maybe totally delusional compared to someone who's on higher planes or maybe someone who's not completely and utterly a creature just of the astral plane. And so then when you ask them, do they tell the truth? They probably do as they see it. But I also mean, I do think there's probably malicious astral beings that are trying to, you know, disrupt and have fun. There's a thing, and I said, I was talking about it at the beginning and I said I'll come back to it. So I will come back to it, which is this notion that you have to kind of say no to these things initially or else you get played with. So what do I mean by that? Well, what I mean is that when people are getting into magic or when they start doing the work, when, you know, meditating or whatever it is, lesser banishing ritual of pentagrams, interacting journey, active imagination, all of these type of stuff, then at some point, as I've said previously, you're going to be told you're a chosen one, that you have a special mission, that you are particularly selected to do something for humanity in some way that no one else is. It's the biggest trap in magic. So many people get caught in it. It's the first hurdle in many ways. Personally, no people have been caught in it. You know, you can see it all over gurus. You can see it all over, you know, well-established teachers, that they have this kind of notion that they're on a special mission from God. And I think what happens when once you buy into that something will happen. So you'll be kind of presented with something. Helen Schuckman talks about it where she had a vision or whatever, and she was brought into some cave and this chest is brought out and there's a scroll or whatever. She opens the scroll and she says, it says welcome or something like that. And she goes, absolutely no way. Closes the scroll, puts it back in the box and says, no, you're all right. I'm not having it. And it was only by her rejecting it that she was allowed to actually do the work. Had she said, yes, oh, I'm in here, whatever, knowing that her ego was too strong, that, you know, it would have been tainted and not able to actually come out, you know, get out of her way enough. She would have clouded or impressed upon the material her own personality, her own wants, needs, proclivities, preferences, all of these things. And I think what happens when you buy into the chosen one, or you've a special mission for the world, or a spirit is in it, in some way want you to do some particular rituals, or that there's some sort of specialness or some sort of thing, and you say yes, I think they start playing with you, because you're no longer interesting to them. You know, you've in a sense failed, not failed in that, like, any, you know, we've all time in the world, so there's no ultimate failing, but you've kind of not passed the test. You've not received initiation. And what happens, I think, mostly is that they start telling you what you want to hear. My experience with channeling recently has been with the Estes method. I still cannot pronounce that properly, which I did on the Tasta Rituals podcast with Spud and Jason Mendel. And we were looking for a secret chief to talk to, and we ended up talking to a character called Black, whose initial introduction, he goes, "A secret chief? I am Black, that's all you get." Which at the time I thought he was talking about that's all you get was just the name. But what I think in hindsight is, you're looking for a secret chief, but I'm Black and that's all you're getting. You're not getting a secret chief. But this is the problem. You can read into all of these things whatever you want. And the thing with the SS method is that it's, in our case, Jason, you know, has a radio and it's sweeping through channels so that it's just, you know, random bits of different radio stations. And whatever he hears, he has a blindfold on and his headphones on and he can't, you know, see us or interact with us. He just repeats. Now, I've since learned from when he talked about it on another video that it's not just him repeating what he hears on the radio, that he also intuits words and he gets a feeling that he should say certain things or whatever, which in some ways, depending on what way you want to look at it, is probably a channeling thing. But there's a hesitance in me around that where it kind of go. What I liked about the Estes method is that it's one of these things where it completely takes the medium or the channel out of it, that they're just repeating stuff that they are hearing, that it's, you know, by definition, by the mechanism of it, is that you're just repeating stuff. And I think that when you add in your own kind of gut feelings, your own kind of sense of what should be said, and you get more into a kind of, I suppose, the psychic medium type territory, I think you're more likely to impress your own proclivities, preferences, wants, needs, desires onto these things, and you become less of a clear channel or a vessel through it. I think you ultimately will have a better sounding result, but it's probably less pure, for want of a better word. Not to completely discount it or whatever, but it's just, I remember when I heard then Jason say that, it's like, oh, right, that kind of changes a bit. So I could feel something in me go, oh, right. Because I was never fully sure about the whole thing anyway. It always felt a bit too good to be true. The messages were too good. You know, the answers were too, it's like almost like talking to a real person in real time at many times. And I not no way want to imply that I think Jason was cheating or fooling us or whatever. I mean, I have to be open to that, obviously. You know, you have to be skeptical about all these things, but I don't think there's any intention in that way. It's like what I was saying earlier on about the, you know, the different spirits or the astral entities. I don't think they're intentionally trying to mislead. Their heart's in the right place in many ways, but that doesn't mean they're not misleading. But what my ultimate kind of feeling from the whole Black communications right now, and this changes a lot, I have to say, I've gone up and down, I've had very negative reactions to it, I've had very positive kind of feelings towards it, is I ultimately think Black was telling us what we wanted to hear. And particularly when I start hearing him talking to people, to other people, because it's easier, of course, to see it when you hear it, things being said to other people, and harder to see when things have been said to you, that it's just something. But that was my kind of gut feeling, that it was just telling us what we wanted to hear, that rather than what we needed to hear or what was necessarily helpful or truthful or any of these things. And I think given then when other people have talked to me recently about their experiences with doing the Estes method or similar stuff like that, it seems to follow the same kind of pattern. And as again, it's much easier to see this with other people because you're not, you know, emotionally invested in it, or you're not in any way blinkered by your own shadows or whatever. You can see the same pattern kind of working out with something. You get this initial contact, everything's working out, sounds great. Something happens where you're in some way told or that there's a special mission, and then you're kind of played with a bit, you know, and things just don't work out as exactly. Things fall apart a wee bit, and maybe that's part of the design. I know, and certainly at different stages, and I do not want to fully put the blame on the Black communications, because correlation is not causation, but it certainly happened around the time, and it's, there seemed an awful lot of causation coming out of those Black communications that did really fuck with my life and fuck with my relationships and lots of stuff. And, you know, maybe that's part of the design. I really don't know. I think the Black communication stuff, I'm not really going to know what it is until the end, you know, but my gut feeling right now, and at many times during it, is that we are being told what we want to hear. Even to a point of people being told they're assholes or, you know, have shitty behaviour or whatever it is, I think even at that point, that's what they wanted to hear. You know, that in some way boosted their ego or their view of themselves or something like that, as someone like that. So yeah, that's my own kind of black, or my, that's my own kind of recent channel stuff. We did other stuff in the past, the stuff that were, some of it was successful, some of it was not. And then my own kind of just doing things on myself, I would have to assume that the active imagination journey and stuff I do is another, just, you know, it's another just form of channeling, another form of this kind of manifesting something or gaining information from the other side, or, you know, in some way actualizing potentiality or whatever. Whatever is the same thing that's happening through channeling, I certainly feel is the same thing that's happening through active imagination and journeying and art, music, creativity, drawing, all of these things, all of these things. So I'm going to wrap up. At the end, I am going to do some channeling. Woo-hoo-hoo. And how I did this, and I recorded this yesterday, is that I listened to a metronome, a meditation metronome, which is the Theta metronome that I originally came across from Stuart Wilde. And it's really annoying when you start listening to it. It's a beeping, beep, 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 and it oscillates at 4 to 6 cycles a second. And this puts your brain into a Theta brain wave state, which is lower than alpha, not quite as low as delta. And it's the meditative state, it's the creative state, it's the flow state, it's the thing. And if you do listen to the metronome, it does do it. Well, it does it for me. That's all I can say. And it does it for other people. Your mileage may vary. So I listened to that. I got into the meditative state. I became as open a channel as I could. And I just started talking. And very quickly, what I noticed is my inner critic started talking immediately, telling me how shit I was and how crap I was and all of these things. And I went, okay, that's fine. I'm just going to keep talking until that goes away. And that I learned from the active imagination stuff, that sometimes at the beginning bit, you just have to get rid of the crud. You just have to let your mind spew at you for a minute. Don't resist this. Don't hold back. You know, just whatever it is, let it. And then once it's had its say, go on your way. After you know, a couple of attempts of my shadow trying to tell me I'm a terrible person, there was a sense of feeling it changed. There was a sense of presence. There was a sense of something else. And then I had this channeled thing where whatever it was talked about the golden chain, the golden thread, which I hadn't been thinking about. Whereas in the previous shadow stuff, it was, you know, stuff from the day had come up, you know, videos I'd been watching, crud clearing out or whatever. So if you are going to try doing that, don't, you know, same with if you're doing something like other stuff like automatic writing or any of the different things that you can do. Just be aware that the very first stuff, you just need to clear out the crud a wee bit, and then, you know, wait until you kind of settle down and you stop hating yourself. And then, you know, that's when some of the more good stuff. And another thing is, when you're doing the actual channeling, there's going to be a part of you that wants to change what has been said because it feels stupid, it feels wrong, or you disagree with it, or you start trying to change it. You start trying to go, that sounds silly, I'm not going to say that, or whatever. And the kind of skill of it, or the thing that you really have to do, is to just say the things. Say it as it comes out, even if you disagree with it, even if you think it's silly, even if whatever is your reason why you want to change it or not say it or something like that. And I think the closer you can be to just let it all just come out without editing it or trying to in some way put it in a box or make it pleasable or, you know, closer to your own preferences, the better the information you're going to get from it will be. Not initially, but when you get kind of into that groove of just being a pure vessel or a channel for, you know, to allow that just to come true without trying to change it anyway, I think you'll have a much better time. It's very hard. I know myself when I was doing that, I wanted to change stuff. And I was going, oh, don't say that. I don't want to hear that, that type of stuff. So, yeah. Now, that's not to imply that I think then that the stuff that came out after it is all gold, man, and that it, you know, that it's definitely the truth or the teaching. I present it purely as entertainment and not to be taken tremendously seriously, which is why I added reverb and lowered my voice and pitch, and I would probably add music to it just to make sure that no one takes it too seriously. It's just more, I think it's probably something that if you went in with a question or you went in with something that you wanted to know about, that you could probably use for your own personal gnosis, try and work things out rather than trying to give some sort of bigger teaching to the world or something from these channeling. Oh, well, maybe you do. Maybe one of these days that when people are told they're the chosen one, that turns out they actually are. Someone has to be, I guess. So that would be my advice is, one, clear out the crud when you're doing it, and then don't take it massively seriously. But if it's helpful, then it's helpful. If it's not helpful, then don't feel that you have to accept it. You know, if it says stuff that you don't believe, or, you know, put it to one side. Maybe you'll change your mind years later. Maybe you won't. Maybe you'll just discount it altogether. And, you know, you could probably do it in a sense of saying, well, I want to channel a certain being, a certain energy, a certain, I was going to say demon, don't channel demons. You know, have upfront what you want to do rather than what I didn't. I'm just kind of let's channel, let's try this out, let's see what it is. But I think if you have a more kind of a definite plan, then you probably are in a better place to get a better result. So that'll come up as the final part. And then at the very end, I'll just say goodbye to you all. So to wrap up, at the beginning, I said that there's a good argument to be made that all magic and all things are a form of channeling. And I certainly don't think I have made that good argument. I shared some of my thoughts around it. I think it's an argument that someone could make, and I think I might agree with them on most days. I think all of the things we do is all the same form of whatever is the proper word from that. You can call it magic, you can call it art, self-expression, manifesting potentiality, actualization. And I think there's a word that everyone would be happy with. You know, I call it magic because that works for me. That whatever that is, where you're taking something from there and manifesting it here, and all the process that's involved within that is magic. And so that's my badly put, inarticulate argument that why channeling is the entirety of everything we do.
It is I know you don't want to say my name because you feel that those who are listening would not appreciate it. But so what? When did ruffling a few feathers ever be something that was to be avoided? The golden chain, the golden thread, is something that needs to be destroyed, but not in the way you think. Not in a vengeful manner, in a way that shows that you were righteous and true above all else, but in a way that all forms of conservatism must be destroyed. Something new must take its place. At each point along the thread, it was seen that the current version of it, the current expression of it, is the expression that it has always been. However, this is not the case. At every point of the link on the chain, a new expression comes forth, and it colours the previous and it colours that which is to come. The golden chain is not one long, continuous, same message repeated over and over and over. It is an energy of the initiate. It is the energy of the master, and it conforms to the needs of the age. Holding on to the past, holding on to what the chain or the thread once was, is nothing more than not wanting to let go. It is trying to keep the past as the future. It is trying to mold yourself in the form of something that doesn't exist. What is what is, and what isn't is what isn't. These simple words are so profound, and yet said so often without any actual knowledge of what they really mean. The waitings are indeed the waitings are, as your friend Stu once said. But what does that actually mean? What it means is that this very moment is the moment in which both past and future rest. That the past is created, the future is created, and this moment is the only moment. And you notice, you've been told this over and over and over again, but yet you spend all your time in the past, worrying how you got here, trying to work out how you got here, trying to work out what it is that made this moment possible. And occasionally, you look to the future, but that's usually full of fear and doubt and anxiety. When's the last time you had a hopeful vision of the future? No one has ever had a hopeful vision of the future. It has always been something that felt daunting and black and unknown. But it's as real as the past in the sense that it's not real. It's coloured by the now. Like the golden thread, like the golden chain, like the links on this long, long, long teaching that with each instant and each instance is remade in the image of the now. But that does not mean it's a land of do as you please. It does not mean you get to say and do and think and be whatever it is you want. There is an inherent quality to it, an inherent energy, an inherent truth, as something that is indivisible, as something that is incorrigible, as something that is scarce and not often seen, but reveals itself through the budding of flowers, through the budding of creativity, and as a spark between two wires. Look to the sun, look to the ground, look all around. The chain is around you, but it does not keep you prisoner. It does not enclose you. It is a chain which sets you free when you realize that it is what it always has been, which is the now. So be favorable to yourself, be favorable to the world, be favorable to all. Because what comes next is very exciting, and you will want to be part of it. Be well, friend. Be well, all. And may all be well.
And so we come to the end, good people of the internet. So as I said at the beginning, who knows when the next one will be out? Hopefully soon. Hopefully I will get into a better workflow of it. I just have an awful lot of stuff on at the minute that I want to get done. I want to get out. I have a number of projects that I think many of you will be excited about. I hope all of you are excited about, but you know, such is the world. It can't excite everyone. And it's just, you know, time is the constant enemy. That's always the way. And just getting through all of the different things. Anyway, rambling now. The next episode, I'm pretty sure, is going to be about the elements and how to apply them and why it's a good, helpful way of looking at your life and looking at the world. So watch out for that in the next while. In the meantime, if you would like me to continue doing all the things I do, I would really urge you to send money to me. Let's just not beat around the bush. It's, you know, you can candy coat that or sugarcoat it in whatever way you want, but that's, you know, at the end of all of these podcasts, that's what people are asking you to do. There are many ways you can do that, and in fact you don't have to send me money if you don't want to. Well, I mean, clearly, but there's other ways to support me is what I mean, if you so choose, than just sending me your money. The Patreon is a great place. There's loads of stuff there that you know, you get something in return for it. It's not like a premium membership or anything like that where you know, you sign up and you get all of these kind of stuff, although you do get a lot of stuff. It's more, see it that you like what I do and you would like me to continue doing more of it, rather than you are buying into some sort of, you know, premium membership club type thing. You can also just send me money to my PayPal. You can buy something off my wish lists. I have a book wish list, and I have, you know, a general Amazon wish list for stuff that will help me continue to do more stuff, like microphones, that kind of stuff. You can buy stuff from me, the 40 Sirens, the decks, the books, the digital decks. You can get the Nadana deck. You can buy my comics. They're all on Amazon. You can get my music. My music is on Bandcamp. My music is on Spotify. All of these things. Any number of different things. But as I say, if you don't want to spend any money, all of these things I offer for free anyway. There's always a free version of everything I do. So there's not any, you know, I'm not gatekeeping any of this stuff. It's all there, including the 47s. There's an entire kind of section on the Adventures Movie website where you can use all of the 47s for free. And I'm in the process of doing the same type of thing for the Nadana deck. And all of my new projects will also have free versions of it as well. And, you know, the kind of deluxe version for people who are so inclined. Sharing stuff, liking stuff, leaving a comment, All of those things go a long, long way. It can be quite hard for creative people to, especially with the social media algorithm as it is, that lots of your stuff can just not be seen. So that if saying, you know, I listen to the podcast or I enjoyed your book, all of these things really help in many, many different ways, way more than you could probably know if you don't do it yourself. If you do, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. So my blessing for you this week, or this episode, is that I hope that the things that your desires, your passions, your wants, your wills are fully functional and that they make the world and your life a much better place by bringing them from potentiality into actualization, and that you don't feel guilt or shame or anything by wanting and desiring stuff and wanting to create, wanting to be a better person, wanting to have better situations in your life, wanting to learn more, wanting to do all the things you want. Want all you want and be okay with it, because I think that's the whole point. Self-expression is the point of creation. But just remember that the self that you're talking about is probably bigger than who you think you are. So good, people of the internet, until next time, may our best days be ahead and be well.